Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Hyundai, supporting the drive to keep our distance. chse.ie for more.
Thank you very much, Susan Jackson. I'm so sorry. I was getting ahead of myself there. I do indeed have Suzanne Lynch now. As you heard on the news there, I guess if the US was a tinderbox ready to go, George Floyd was the match that was applied to that. Of course, George Floyd died in police custody. I'm sure you've all seen that horrific video of the officer kneeling on his neck in Minneapolis. Suzanne Lynch is Washington correspondent with the Irish Times, and she is in Atlanta, Georgia now, I believe. Suzanne, good afternoon.
Good morning, Brendan.
So just for people who've missed it, just briefly the background to this story.
Yes, well, the protests that we've seen throughout the country and that happened here last night in Atlanta, from where I'm speaking to you, they were prompted by an incident on Monday in Minneapolis. That's a big city in Minnesota in the Midwest of the United States. And on Monday evening, a man in police custody, then in hospital, died. And video emerged. A passerby had taken some footage of the phone of this man, George Floyd, being handcuffed, restrained, face down on the side of the street beside a curb and kind of half hidden by a police car from the video footage that was circulated. And for several minutes, one of the police officers held his knee on the man's neck. And what is so disturbing in so many ways about this video is, and I was writing about it, is the kind of silence, the ordinariness of the scene. It's very quiet, and all you can hear is the man groaning, saying repeatedly, "I can't breathe," and essentially pleading for his life. Then some passersby try to intervene. They kind of say to the police officer, "He can't breathe, you know, please stop doing this." They don't. And eventually an ambulance comes along. He has stopped moving at this stage. An ambulance has come along. He's put in the ambulance. The video stops. Then we know later on that he died.
Now, so Suzanne, the officer has subsequently been arrested. I know the officers involved were fired initially. He has now been arrested, but obviously this has taken on a momentum of its own now. And I think it's about 30 cities across America. We're now seeing protests slash riots slash looting. You're in Atlanta, and we saw footage there of protests at the CNN headquarters. What are you seeing in Atlanta?
So in Atlanta last night, on Friday night, was the first big night of rioting all over the country. We had smaller riots throughout the week. So Atlanta in Georgia, this is the headquarters of CNN. It's a big city in this part of the world. It's got a lot of big businesses here. On Friday night, there was widespread kind of looting, clashes with police, and at one stage an attempt to enter the CNN building. I was here last night, and look, it was pretty shocking scenes, Brendan. I was in front of the CNN headquarters, and you know, shortly before nightfall, effectively, there was what you call a standoff between police and protesters here. Now, the mayor of Atlanta had called a curfew earlier in the day from 9 p.m. So I was driving into the city, you know, at tea time around 6 o'clock, and you could see the cars driving into the downtown area. Like many parts of America, you know, it's the suburbs most people live in. So the downtown area could generally be relatively quiet. So cars were driving in, and there were masses of police cars blocking some roads. Then by 7 p.m., 2 hours before the curfew, it was full on protesting. And there was maybe 20 foot between the police lines. They were in full riot gear and lines of protesters. The protesters were chanting George Floyd, chanting "Don't shoot," and eventually it began to get more violent. People started throwing water bottles into the crowd. The National Guard was also deployed. They were kind of lined up. They marched in and were subject to huge verbal abuse from the protesters there. Some of the protesters, not all, many of them were African American. And they were shouting at some of the National Guards, who were blacks themselves.
So, Suzanne, did it look to you like a peaceful protest being inflamed by heavy-handed cops? And we've seen some fairly shocking footage of police behaviour towards people. Or did it look to you like peaceful protest being possibly hijacked by people who are just looking to make trouble?
Well, I didn't see any heavy-handed action by the police from what I saw. But most of the people there were protesting peacefully. But there were some elements where it was getting more tense. So I personally didn't. I can see there was coverage, particularly from New York, of different scenes there. I would say it was a highly charged and quite a violent atmosphere. And the noise, the screaming was huge. The intensity of the accusations that were being hurled by a lot of people in the crowd to the police. Then what happened was that there was a real sense, which I think happened all over the country, of the building up to a curfew. Some people I was speaking to said to me that they thought that was very provocative, that the mayor had announced a curfew. People were supposed to be off the streets from 9 p.m. until sunrise this morning. So everyone, of course, had the sense, as it got close to 9 p.m, what was going to happen. Now, with me, I got moved with the main crowd, if you like, north of the city, as the police began to disperse people. Tear gas was used, were fireworks. But at that stage, people started dispersing. And, you know, throughout the evening, right up until 11 p.m, I saw different groups of people, in kind of interchanges with police, but there were verbal interchanges, police trying to get them off the streets. But the police presence here was massive. At one point, I saw, I think I would say, about 100 police cars zooming by on each street with sirens. There were helicopters. There were drones. The helicopters, police.
There's a sense people have been saying that this is not, I mean, we heard on the news there that this is about like a lot of unemployed people and that this was something ready to blow. There is a sense as well that this is an open sore in America and that what's actually coming up here is just possibly a recurrence of, I don't know, 400 years of a rent in America. What's the sense of that there?
Well, I think that's correct, Brendan. I mean, I spoke to many people last night at this protest, and nearly every person said what they were protesting about was a system, that they believe the system is skewed towards, against African-American people. And the figures are there, Brendan, in the criminal justice system in this country. America's the highest incarceration rate in the world, and most of those in jail are African-American, mostly young African-American men. Quite recently, Bill Clinton himself has said he regretted there was a huge crime bill here in the 1990s that was about getting tough on crime. And he said that he essentially can see that that made things worse for a lot of African-American men. So I think this is just, as you said, you know, match in a tinderbox. This has not come out of nowhere. Yes, there could be an element of, disillusionment with the current situation, the high unemployment. But I think it's much deeper than that. And also to stress, you know, there was a broad range of people. I was also in protest in Washington on Friday night. I came down here on Saturday. And you had all kinds of people, every race, every age. There's quite a few white people here in solidarity. And just to say as well, I mean, here in Atlanta, this is such a historic place. It's the birthplace of Martin Luther King. It is, 50 years ago when he was shot in Memphis. His funeral cortege made its way across the state up to Atlanta, and there were thousands of people here for a funeral. And it's got a history of, I suppose, non-violent protests. So I think what a lot of the officials here, as senior politicians, have been calling for people to go back to that tradition, and that they're worried now that if it's, and of course we're now in the context of social media and how everything now is reflected on live coverage and sometimes refracted, that it's selectively
and whipped
chosen
up as well, Suzanne. Yeah, I want to bring in the panel, Suzanne, if I can. Kelly from Douglas here says, I'm from the Atlanta area. Friends were there and it was peaceful at first. People were planted. There were Craigslist ads for actors turned into chaos. Martin Luther King would be appalled. Dermot Furter, is this just American history continuing on? This is not a one-off kind of event, is it?
It certainly is a continuance of what has been apparent, not just for decades, but for centuries. I vividly remember the savage assault of Rodney King in 1991, and then the storm of controversy over the trial and the acquittals of white police officers. And at the time, one of the leading civil rights activists in LA was making the point that this was about a paramilitary style approach to policing. And it was mean and it was cruel and it was racist. And it was about abusing force in communities of colour, and especially in communities of poorer people of colour. And you can see, it's not just about the figures in relation to criminal justice, even in relation to COVID. African Americans are three times more likely to be infected with COVID, and they're six times more likely to die from it. So again, it's exposing all of these fault lines. The difficulty at the moment, we can talk about what has happened historically. What we've never had before, of course, is the reckless leadership, if you could call it leadership, which of course you can't really, that sense of throwing oil on the fire day in, day out.
Yeah,
you know, the open incitements to more trouble, the blatantly racist interventions. So that is not only complicating what's a very difficult picture at the moment, it's also setting America up for a really difficult summer and autumn, because you have to consider, of course, the looming election. America is falling apart at the moment.
Yeah. It feels like a Spike Lee movie gone out of control in a way, doesn't it? That just this thing kicks off and suddenly there's no stopping it. Nora?
I started watching, firstly, I have to say that George Floyd, it couldn't be a more inhuman way to leave this world. It was very distressing to watch.
It's absolutely appalling.
And I often think that Black Lives Matter were benefited enormously, no more than domestic violence, by the advent of the smartphone, where you could capture those things, because otherwise they went unnoticed. The other day, Netflix have a great documentary up, executive produced by George Clooney, called Trial by Media. And it's the case, myself and my son watched it, of Amadou Diallo back in 1991. It was the time of Rudy Giuliani. Suzanne just alluded to it, when crime was big crackdown. The police virtually ran in, the NYPD virtually ran Manhattan. And he was shot 41 times. I remember even listening to Bruce Springsteen singing that song and not even knowing it was about this man, this fine young man who left Guinea in Africa, came over and was trying to study and living the big dream. And he's trying to shuffle for his keys in the doorway. And 41 times he's shot by four NYPD officers, who were then indicted and then got off. And the mother, like, it's heartbreaking to watch, because the mother comes over from Guinea and she ends up joining the activists. The mayor wants to put her up and put her in a fine hotel, and she says, no, I'm going to go with the activists and I'm going to live with them. She had such an influence on that case, this is way before Black Lives Matter. And when you see her taking the coffin, which is really just a box, back home to Guinea, and the whole community coming out, devastated that one of their own went to live the dream in America and came back like that. Mm-hmm. And I'm saying to Dara, but it was ages ago, Dara. Like, I mean, it was a long time ago. And then the next second, we open the newspapers and we're reading about George Floyd.
Yeah. Bertie Ahern, we got about 10 minutes into that without a mention of Donald Trump. But is this in reality all about Donald Trump, do you think?
Well, I don't think it's all about Donald Trump, because... as Dermot said, the Rodney King murder was almost 30 years ago, and the trial, that was 1991-92. So, you know, this week watching TV, the last few nights, and particularly American TV, was almost a rerun of what we saw then. And it has continued. Like, this one was caught on video, but it's happening nightly in the black areas. And, you know, it's every year you see articles and you read it in some of the magazines about the stats for the year. And it's really frightening. Now, of course, where Donald Trump comes in is his morning tweets and his nightly press conferences, you know, just aggregate everybody. But I think Joe Biden came out fairly strongly today against some of the protests that were just people that were looking for looting. And I think the pity, and it always happens, that where they had a good case, that people want reform and want equal rights, then it gets lost in the violence.
Yeah,
and that's the pity.
And there are reservoirs of decency across the entire United States and very strong community leadership. The difficulty for them at the moment is that they're not being backed up because of what's going on at the centre, at the highest levels of power. And that's why it becomes then uncontainable.
Yeah.
Suzanne, is Dermot right? Is this it for the summer now in America? Is this going to be the story and the running battle for the summer?
Well, I think it's as you mentioned there, this really did feel like it came out of nowhere this week. Obviously, America has been in lockdown for the last few months. But this has, I think, changed the dynamic of the election, which is now less than 6 months away. Just a couple of points on that. I mean, Joe Biden has made quite a few public statements on this. He's obviously going to be the Democratic nominee to face Donald Trump in November. But he himself has been embroiled in tensions about his own role, for example, in that 1994 crime bill. He's also, only a week ago, he was embroiled in controversy after saying to a very well-known African-American personality, "You ain't black," was the line he used to him, and had to apologise for that. So this is a very fraught issue. Now, what I think is really going to determine how this plays out is Donald Trump's reaction. As we know, Donald Trump have a history of intervening in these kind of culture wars that simmer in American life, and I think has got a very good skill for recognising what motivates some of his base and some of the racism, quite frankly, within some people who vote for Donald Trump. And his own record is not good on this. I mean, back in the day, there was the case of Central Park Five, five young men who were charged with attacking a white woman. They were eventually exonerated. There's also a Netflix documentary about them. And Donald Trump at the time, as a businessman, took out a full-page ad calling for their execution. So I think it'll be interesting how he is going to react in the next few days. Already, he has mentioned about the hard left and, know that this is an extreme fringe group. So if he continues to kind of politicise or divide on this rather than trying to bring the country together, that could be quite provocative. This is a leader, of course, who doesn't seem to want to unite the country. He actually thrives on division and stoking up divisions. That's what he feels galvanises his base. So a lot of people are wondering, will he make some kind of a statement today? His press schedule is completely clear. He's in the White House, and of course, the White House saw a protest. I was there on Friday night, quite violent, our tense protest right outside his door. So it will be interesting to see how he reacts now. But this could play, I think, into, as I say, these broader cultural, racial wars in America.
Okay.
And actually could galvanise some people on the right as much as the left is being galvanised at the moment.
Okay, here we go then. All right, Suzanne Lynch, Washington correspondent with the Irish Times, thank you very much. And thank you indeed to my panel today, former Taoiseach Bertie Ahern, Nora Casey, broadcaster and publisher, and Dermot Farriter, Professor of Modern Irish History in UCD. Before you go, guys, I want to read one text here. Bertie is talking a lot of sense. I'm coming around to forgiving him. Keep it up, Bertie. You were a serious elder statesman. That's from Tony down in Kerry. So
how much did you pay him, Bertie?
I won over somebody yesterday, so you won over one of them today.
I still want to be Kerry in the All-Ireland if we ever have one this year.
All right. Thanks a million, guys. Let's take a break.
Text 51551. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Sorry, welcome back. A texter here, just for balance on Trump. Great show, Brendan. These protests are in Democrat-controlled cities. Trump has no control over them. Classic blaming Trump. So let the record show that we have balanced that. Now, I'm joined in the studio by our culture panel, if you will. So Brian Redden is a producer and director, and Mary O'Sullivan is features and travel editor of the Sunday Independent and a former TV researcher. And that bit, why that's important will become clear in a minute. But what we're going to do first, before we talk about general cultural highlights, is that we're going to talk to John McKenna. So what we were thinking, what makes a great television moment? You know, one of those things that just stops you in your tracks and that you remember it for the rest of your life. So we asked John, who's a writer and a broadcaster, what the TV moments he has that are seared in his memory. And look, you'll agree with some of these and you'll have your own ones and everything. And do text us in on 51551 or email Brendan at RT and tell us what your stop in your tracks TV moments are. So John, afternoon.
Good afternoon, Brendan.
John, looking at this list, it strikes me that they're pretty much all from live television broadcasts. And they are, I suppose, that thing that in live television you're always gagging for, which is the thing that nobody expected to happen.
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose a lot of them, as we go through them, are from a time when there was less television. Well, certainly where I was living, there was less television available. And therefore, when the moment happened, it was something extraordinary. And you've just been talking to Suzanne and the panel about George Floyd. I mean, there's an up-to-the-moment event on television which kind of has stopped people in their tracks and has stunned them. But for me, I think those moments where everything was banal and everything was ordinary and everything was predictable, and then suddenly something happened or something went off the rails or something unexpected occurred.
Yeah.
Those are the moments that I really, really, really remember.
And of course, so many of them happened in this country on the Late Late Show. And
yeah,
we're going to start with a clip from the Late Late Show. This is Gay Byrne in May 1997. And maybe we'll play this one first, and then you can tell me why it's so memorable. So this is at the end of the show when Gay is ringing a competition winner and then found out what was going on in Rita Hanley's life.
Now, who are Rita Hanley? Yes.
Ah, Rita.
Yes.
Good evening. My name is Byrne. You may have heard of me. Gay Byrne.
Yes.
The Late Late Show.
Yes.
Hello. Testing.
Yes, I'm here.
Are you in Fitzgerald Road in Toker and Cork?
That's right.
You are. And you sent in a card with the correct answer, Charlie Haughey, to our postal quiz.
Yes.
Very good, Rita. Are you happy, Rita?
Yes.
Were you watching the show tonight?
I was. My daughter died last night.
Oh, no. Oh, dear, Rita. I'm very sorry. Oh, dear, oh, dear. How old was she, Dot?
Pardon?
How old was she?
33 years of age.
And why did she die?
Are you being funny?
No. Why did... What did she... What
she
did
was she... knocked down. She had a fatal car crash last night.
Where did this happen?
In Toker.
And what was she driving?
Or
was
no. She... No, she was walking.
She was walking.
She was knocked down by a car.
And she was knocked down by a car?
Yes.
Good heavens. And how many others in the family have you?
I have six more.
And was she married?
No, she wasn't. She was single.
And she was just walking along the road?
Yes. She was going. No, the bus when she was knocked down.
And was she killed instantly?
Well, almost. She died exactly 2 hours after.
And stupid. How are you getting through this?
Very badly. But she gave her strength. She was one of the best daughters anybody could ever have. Linda was her name.
And do you want to answer this question?
I do, for Linda.
For Linda. Okay. It's your choice. All right, it's an easy one. What's the usual alcoholic ingredient in Irish coffee?
Whiskey.
Whiskey is right. You won. Whiskey. I'm at a loss to know what to say to you, Rita.
I know. As I said, since Linda has died last night, there's a lot of little things that have happened like that. And she posted the card for me. I don't know what to say.
Well, you cope with your sorrow.
Thank you.
That is, John, an extraordinarily moving moment still. And like, I can actually picture Gay's face when he said, oh no, I can see his face doing it. Why did you pick that clip?
It's funny, Brendan, just even listening back to it now and hearing it again, I mean, it sends shivers down my spine. I picked it because it was one of those moments, because of the banality of it. You know, the quiz thrown in at the end of the Late Late Show, just squeezed in the last 30 seconds. And I remember reading an interview at one stage with Graham Norton, where he said that was one of the moments that made him realise what a brilliant, brilliant broadcaster Gay Byrne was. What followed that, Brendan, I don't know if you remember this, Brendan Kennelly, the poet, was on the panel that night. And after he had spoken to Rita Hanley, Gay turned to him and he said, "Is there anything you would like to say?" And just off the top of his head, Brendan Kennelly recited his poem Begin, which is a poem about hope and possibility and beginning again. And I've just never forgotten that moment, because it was the ordinariness of it that kind of stopped me in my tracks. And the fact that any of us put into that situation, I mean, what do you say to somebody when you're being funny with them and then you suddenly realise that they're in the middle of a tragedy?
Yeah, okay. Now, another tragedy, but this is a sporting one. Remind us, John, about what happened at the Heysel Stadium on the 29th of May 1985, and tell us why this is an important moment.
Liverpool playing Juventus, 1985, European football, soccer competition. Aggravation between the fans, not particularly well handled by the police. The collapse of a wall, and suddenly 39 people die. And I chose this because I remember watching this match, and the match went ahead eventually. The decision was taken that it would be better to have the match, because if the match were cancelled, then all hell had already broken loose, but all hell might break loose even further. And for me, I remember listening to the commentary, and there was about an hour's delay, and the shock, the horror, the disbelief in the voices of the commentators who were there, and then back and forth to the studio, and I suppose not realising really at a distance, it looked like there had been just been trouble, and there often was trouble at football at that stage. And then bit by bit, the dawning of the fact that people had died, and then the banality again of the soccer match going ahead at the end of it.
Yeah, we have a clip here, and I think this is... This is the BBC studio panel, right? Continuing describing what they're seeing as they wait for the teams to come out. So the presenter here is Jimmy Hill and the analysts are Terry Venables and the first analyst you'll hear is Graham Souness. Let's...
Maybe they're not going to play it. I mean, maybe they're going to try and keep one set of supporters in the ground, but they'll go home. But you're going to have the same problem in the city tonight. When they play it or if they don't play it. After the game, both sets of supporters are going to be in the city after the game.
So it is virtually an impossible situation, really, for anybody to decide what is the right course of action. In fact, whatever is done is going to appear to be wrong.
That's right.
The Red Cross at the stadium say that 30 killed and 100 are seriously injured in hospital. With so much trouble, it doesn't seem feasible, really, for players to come out and play a game in that atmosphere.
It's a game of football. I mean,
Graham's just said about parents worrying if their sons are okay. It's almost like you're talking about them going off to war.
Yeah. I mean, that's what's come to them when our teams go to Europe now. But once again, it's minority, and so many innocent people get caught up in it.
I think Barry Davis weighed it very well. It's a severe embarrassment for everyone, and now it's gone beyond that. It's a tragic. Now it's tragic.
Okay, it's surreal stuff, John.
He put his finger on it there when he said it's an impossible situation, and I suppose that's one of the things about all of the moments we remember are that they are, when we look at them, we think, God, this is an impossible situation. And we watch somebody try to get out of it or deal with it.
Yeah. Speaking of which, people are texting into 51551 their favourite TV moments. Gay, if he's looking down, would be delighted because a lot of them are Gay Byrne on the Late Late Show. The Late Late Show episode where Gay Byrne was interviewing Grace Jones, cringeworthy stuff. Did Gay Byrne interview Grace? Is that Pat... No, I think that was one of the English chat show hosts,
yes,
wasn't it? Russell Harty, and
yes.
she slapped him. Gay wouldn't have ever made cringeworthy stuff. Christy Brown saying F on the Late Late Show, that's from Tom Gilsonan. Jimmy McGee's commentary of John Tracy winning silver at the Olympics features in these TV moments. She hopes that features. That's Orla. Riverdance first time. Haughey speech in the Doyle shafting Brian Lenehan. Noreen losing her seat via electronic voting. The young man standing in front of the tanks in Tiananmen Square in 1989. And Tony Morgan says Christy O'Connor's shot to the 18th at the 1989 Ryder Cup. Brilliant. Now, let's take another Late Late Show one. Let's be unapologetic about it because this is another one of those moments that everyone who saw it will never forget. John, tell us about Padraig Flynn on The Late Late in 1999.
Yeah, it's funny. One of the things I remember with The Late Late back in the days when Gay Byrne was presenting it was the fact of the audience involvement. It's a thing that seems to have disappeared, you know, and in a number of the clips.
I don't know that it has, but yeah.
Well, the interaction, say, with the audience, people kind of tended to voice their opinions from the audience. But anyway, Padraig Flynn was on and... He was European Commissioner at the time. He was talking about the difficulty. He was replying to a question about the difficulty of maintaining three houses, one in Dublin, one in Europe and one in Mayo, and the cost of having three housekeepers and running three houses and how difficult it was to make ends meet on his salary as European Commissioner. And I remember watching it at the time and thinking, I could almost see... I had this vision, I remember, at the time of him sinking into a bog. And that the more he spoke, the further he was sinking into the bog because he was talking to people who were really doing their best to make ends meet in everyday life. And here was somebody who was bemoaning the fact that it was very difficult.
He was quite high on himself, I think.
He was.
The description
that's one way.
As my mother would say, there was only one direction he could go in. Let's have a listen to Pete Flynn on The Late Late.
I get... Give or take, it works out at about, with expenses, 140,000 a year, and I pay 30.3% tax on that, so it's about a net 100,000. And out of that 100,000, I run a home in Dublin, Castlebar, and Brussels. I want to tell you something. Try it sometime when you have a couple of cars and three houses and three homes and a few housekeepers, and I want to tell you and everything else, but remember, it's a well-paid job. It's a well-paid job. About 100,000 a year net. running three houses. Do you need three houses?
Well, I have to live somewhere.
Brussels, yes. And then Dublin.
Yes.
And
Castlebar. Yeah.
So you're in.
And don't forget, it's a very interesting thing, and I know very well that the families here will understand this, that even though you're not living in a house, if you're coming back to it every month, you have to heat it and light it and do all the other repairs on it. So the only thing that's different is the price of the food.
Okay.
So it's a very expensive business.
Well, rising out of that, you've come a long way, P, haven't you?
Oh, yeah. I've had a charmed...
beginnings.
Yes, and I've had a charmed political existence. I started
Do you
off...
Think so?
Of course I have. Listen, and I had choices all along the way. I was doing very well in business, of course, when I went into politics originally, and I was elected to Mayo County Council in 1967. And from that, I went to Dáil Éireann in 77. I was a minister at 80, and I've been there or thereabouts the top ever since.
That is even better than I remember. We're going to play that clip every week on the show as a warning to everybody to keep a cool head on yourself. Good God. And I'd say Gay couldn't believe he was getting this gift, egging him on, like, your man getting higher. Classic stuff. Mary O'Sullivan, were you around on the Late at that stage?
No, I was gone at that stage, yeah.
What would be your standout TV moment?
In the Late?
No, in general.
I was there for the R.D. Lang. Do you remember that?
No, but your standout TV moment as a viewer.
As a viewer.
To R.D. Lang.
Okay.
Yeah. Maybe something non-Late, actually.
Yes.
Something that isn't. There was other television, I'm informed. Yeah.
Well, one of my standout moments was, but it's not sad or poignant or controversial.
Oh, thank God. we want to mix it up a bit, yeah.
It was Pride and Prejudice in 1995. It's hilarious now because they're all talking about the sex in Normal People. And in Pride and Prejudice, it was a great series, and Colin Firth was the star. And do you remember the lake scene?
No, I don't. But tell us.
Well,
tell
no clothes at all were taken off. This is the hilarious part.
Okay.
No nudity whatsoever. And the story, as you know, of Pride and Prejudice is the Bennets.
We don't need the whole story of Pride and Prejudice.
Yes, what happened was Elizabeth Bennet, who had turned down Colin Firth, Mr. Darcy, was inside in his house, unbeknownst to him, admiring all his treasures and thinking to herself, "Why did I turn him down?" Yeah. Next thing, she came out and was walking around the grounds. Meanwhile, while she was admiring the treasures, Darcy had dived into his lake, fully clothed, came out, and next thing she saw him. And you could see her. No clothes, as I say, were taken off. Yet the whole country swooned.
Really,
this sexy man, as we saw him, with fully clothed. And the hilarious thing is, he's been in tons of movies since then. And I'm always looking for Mr. Darcy in every role he plays.
Yeah, I don't think he ever got away from it, did he?
No, he's incredibly ordinary altogether.
Brian Redden, a TV moment from you? It does not have to be from the Late.
Okay. Serious or not? I'd say, to keep it light, I think, Who Shot J.R.?
Who Shot J.R.?
Yeah. Who Shot J.R.? I mean, it was one of the biggest things ever to happen on television.
For anyone under the age of 90, this was a show called Dallas. Yeah. They were innocent times.
Yeah.
And this was about as exciting as
it was. J.R. Ewing, played by Larry Hagman.
Yeah.
Okay, so he's the bad guy in it, and he gets shot. And we don't know who shot. And it was a cliffhanger at the end of one season.
Yeah.
So we had to hang on and wait. There was no internet then, there was no Twitter, nobody could tell you who did it. I remember people in the States were writing home to, because it aired in the States 2 days before it aired in Ireland. They were trying to write home to say who did it. But I don't know if you remember. I remember at the time, RT ran a piece where the film was brought in. Do you remember seeing this on TV? It was on the news.
Yes.
They brought
the
film under security.
Yeah.
He brought it in under security guards and took it off the plane and was put in the back of a big kind of a Brinks van, and it was brought into the RT studio so we'd find out finally who shot JR. It spawned t-shirts and key rings and bumper stickers. It was an amazing TV. Yeah. I mean, eventually, we ruin it for people and tell them who shot him. Do you remember? Spoiler alert, who shot JR?
Go on, I forgot.
It was
so important to me at the time.
It was Crystal. It was Sue Ellen's sister.
I thought it was a dream.
No,
that was Bobby
was a dream.
Bobby was
in the shower.
It was Crystal.
We're losing a lot of people.
Sorry.
Let's not confuse the matter. Listen, I want to go to another one with you, John. And this is, it's not light, but it was an extraordinarily strange thing to happen. Tommy Cooper, live television, May 1984. Tell us about it.
Yeah, it was on London Weekend Television. And funny, when I was thinking about this, this was the first one that came to my mind. Not because it was huge in scale, but I think because it was so small in scale. Tommy Cooper was doing his magic slash comedy routine in front of a live audience in the theatre. It was a live television show. His assistant had been with him on television right up to the moment. And just as she turned to leave, he was about to perform one of his magic tricks. And he seemed to lose his footing and fell backwards onto the curtain behind him. And the crowd laughed uproariously. And then he slumped down a little bit further and the crowd laughed even more.
OK, let's play the clip. And if you want to talk over it, John, you can just to explain.
Oh, who did it? Take it.
So he's beginning to go through his routine here. His assistant has just walked off stage. The crowd is watching him. And he slumps backwards against the curtain, which is closed behind him. And everybody laughs uproariously. And then this is one of the things that really gets me. I don't know if you can hear it on this clip, but you can hear him breathing very heavily because he's just had a heart attack. And a hand reaches out. Somebody from behind the curtain reaches out, obviously, to see if what's happening. And the crowd find this even funnier. And then it goes to an ad break. And it was just one of those moments where I remember watching it, thinking, is this part of it? And the irony of this man who was, I found him extraordinarily entertaining and ridiculous.
Yeah.
And the ridiculousness, and again, the banality of it, the ridiculousness of somebody dying, literally, in front of the audience, and how the audience thought, this is part of the act, this is really funny, this is physical theatre.
Okay.
And then we discover, you know, a couple of minutes later that the man has died.
Yeah, extraordinary. John, stay with us. I've been enjoying myself so much I haven't been taking breaks, so I'll be killed. Let's take a break.
Email brendan@rte.ie.
Welcome back. I have to say, we're going to do this every week because this is the most engaged all of you have ever been. The text pouring in. We've given Gay a lot of props now. Let's give Pat a mention as well. The late stick your toy show moments. Pat Kenny, Jimmy and Lucan, that's true. Somebody arguing with themselves on the text there. Brendan, it was Kirsten and not Crystal who shot JR. Crystal, I think, was in Dynasty. That's from Alan and Lucan. Yeah, somebody else texting in. Sorry, it was Kirsten. John, I want to do one more clip and we'll finish up. Let's finish up with another late one. And this is the classic setup of the drunk guest. Tell us briefly about R.D. Lang.
R.D. Lang, world-renowned psychologist, psychiatrist, on with Gay Byrne, 1985, I think it was, and certainly under the weather. I think that was the phrase, perhaps, that Gay Byrne used with him. And actually, that was the point I was making earlier. One of the interesting things, because Gay challenged him about the fact that he was drunk on air. And then somebody in the audience challenged Gay and said, no, he's not drunk, it's just the way he speaks.
Excellent. Okay, let's have a listen to it.
It was a great moment.
I didn't say you drunk too much. I wanted to know...
Or anything at all. What's that got to do with the...
Because it is perfectly obvious to people that you are under the weather and you are slow.
Hey, I'm not under the weather.
But you are.
I'm not under the weather at all. I'm just behaving as I usually behave. I'm not speeding myself up for the cameras or for you.
Nobody wanted me to speed you up, to speed up.
Oh, well, what are you saying to me just now?
Well, what I'm saying is that there is an unwritten rule for anybody who is going to appear on television that you don't... What?
That's your rule.
You get your rules.
Where do you get the rules from?
But if
I mean, that is your rule.
Yes, it is my rule.
Why does that man be entitled to speak at whatever rate he wishes to speak?
No, I'm not talking about the way he's speaking. I'm talking the way...
But you're laying out the rules. That man should live his life.
The rule is...
That's excellent, isn't it? Wasn't television so democratic in those days? Anyone could chime in and they get a good old hearing from Gay. Listen, John McKenna, we'll definitely return to that with you another time. I think there's plenty more in that. Thank you very much, John McKenna.
Thanks,
now, Mary O'Sullivan, just before we leave R.D. Lang, you were the person responsible for this, and that you were minding Artie Lang that day. What the hell happened? No,
what happened actually was he came in, the late in those days was on a Saturday, and he came in on a Thursday and he gave a talk to a school, and he was absolutely polluted on the Thursday night. And of course, I nearly died, but I had arranged to meet him the next day and he was sober. Luckily, I taped him. Brought the tape to Gay and said he was drunk on the Thursday night, but he was sober on the Friday morning. And Gay said, well, let's make sure, we'll still go with him, he said, but let's make sure that he's completely sober. So we told his minders to keep him sober. Sadly, I think the minders got a bit jarred as well. And he arrived at the studio absolutely polluted. And we poured cup after cup of coffee into the man. And he seemed fine by the time we were going on. But sadly, the lights of the studio, the heat, everything made him drunk all over again. And Ulick O'Connor was there. And of course, Ulick, who died last year, loved controversy. And he really stirred it up as well. And I thought I was going to lose my job. But luckily, it was a TV moment. So,
OK, listen, we have to get to our cultural highlights too. But I have to take another break first.
Listen back on the RTE Radio Player app. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Now, Brian Redden and Mary O'Sullivan are with us, and we're literally going to do a quick 5-minute romp through some cultural highlights. Brian Redden, the notion of the bank holiday movie on TV seems kind of irrelevant at the moment.
It kind of does.
It is a bank holiday, and there are some good movies on.
It is a bank holiday, and traditionally there's going to be some great movies on Monday on the bank holiday. Two I'd recommend. One's on RTE at 3 o'clock on Monday, and it's Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. But what would be a bank holiday without Chitty Chitty Bang Bang? You have to have it. A great movie, one I remember from my childhood. It's brilliantly done. I mean, when you look at it, like, when you think the people behind that, you know, it was written by Ian Fleming. Ian Fleming wrote Chitty Chitty
Bang
Bang.
Really? Yeah, yeah.
It was adapted for the screen by Roald Dahl. And Roald Dahl famously changed it a lot from Ian Fleming's original novel by introducing probably one of the greatest villains of all time, the Child Catcher. And if you watch that movie, the Child Catcher is just horrific, even to this day. Yeah. Played by a guy called Robert Heltman, who was actually a ballet dancer, an Australian ballet dancer. And you can tell by his movements on screen when he's looking for the kids. I get you, my child. Oh, he's unbelievable. So Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, if you want to entertain and scare the hell out of the
kids. And
you
set it up beautifully as well. I'd watch it in a whole different way and with all those bits of information. Listen, for there's a new, the people behind the US version of The Office, which is very, very funny.
It's very good.
Have a new show out.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
So Steve Carell and the guys behind the US version of The Office, you said, which is surprisingly good. This is a new series and it's called Space Force. And it's on Netflix now. It's 10 episodes, 10 half-hour episodes. And it is surprisingly good. It's about the first US Space Force, simple as that. A fictional president, who's clearly Trump, wants boots on the moon by 2028. Although it was a typo in his tweet and he said boobs on the moon instead. And Steve Carell is this five-star general who's given the task of creating America's very first Space Force. Great cast, really funny. John Malkovich is in it. Lisa Kudrow is in it. But best of all, the late, great Fred Willard, who died a couple weeks ago. His last screen appearance. And it's really, really good. Very, very funny.
Excellent. Now, Mary, we've talked about Unorthodox a bit in here on Sunday. This is the set in the Hasidic Jewish community in Williamsburg. You have a few other shows for people who liked Orthodox and want a bit more Hasidim in their lives.
Yes, exactly. Well, there's a brilliant documentary called One of Us. It's 90 minutes long and it's very dark, but it is really, really powerful. It's not sanitized, I suppose, the way Unorthodox was. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's three stories of three people who left the community. And one was a mother of seven at the age of 30. And she left. And
it sounds like Ireland.
Yeah, exactly. In fact, Brian and I were talking about big families before this, but she leaves with her kids because her husband was an abuser. And they then put all the might of the courts and all their money behind their effort to get the children back from her. And they did. And she ended up getting to see them 1 hour a week or something like that. I won't tell you the whole story.
And then
there are three people. But it's really, really powerful. I would highly recommend it.
Okay.
And Stiesel then is a drama. It's like a soap. And it's set in Jerusalem. It's a similar community. I don't think they call it Hasidic. I think they call it Harudi. And they have the ringlets and the top hats. But it's fabulous. It's a love story. Stiesel himself, Akiva, the young man, like is has a great love story going for him there.
And, and it's the fabulous texture of the place and the community and everything else. By the way, for people who are interested in that kind of thing, there's a great book I read years ago, Reva Mann, The Rabbi's Daughter. It's very racy, but it's about one. She runs off to join a Hasidic community. She's Jewish and come out of it since. It's called The Rabbi's Daughter. Look, unfortunately, that's all we have time for today. You've loads more cultural highlights, both of you. So will you definitely come back in a few weeks? So that thank you very much, Mary O'Sullivan and Brian Redden. And that's all we have time for. Today's show was produced by the series producer, Anne Farrell. Research was by Michelle Brown and Katrina McFadden. Bridget Nicholas was our broadcast coordinator. And on sound was Tom Norton. And I'll leave you with one more PJ in Dublin, his TV moment. And like when you look at America today and you think back to this, what about JFK's funeral? 5 hours solo commentary by Micheál O'Hare. So there you go. Thanks, PJ. In Dublin, and look for the day that's in it. And with all that in mind, we leave you today with Nina Simone.